Hello, this is Debbie back on Wednesday, December 23rd, reading from the e-edition of the Herald and Review for Decatur. Starting on the front page, National Forecast Plays Tricks with Winter. This is by Jean Johnson, an AP writer. Seattle. A weather pattern partly linked with El Niño has turned winter upside down across the U.S. during a week of heavy holiday travel. It comes with spring-like warmth to the northeast, a risk of tornadoes in the south, and so much snow across the west that even skiing slopes have been overwhelmed. In a reversal of typical Christmas, forecasters expect New York to be in the mid-60s on the holiday, several degrees higher than Los Angeles. The mild conditions have helped golf courses in New England do brisk business, but the pattern comes at a steep cost for ski resorts that have closed and for backcountry skiers who confront avalanche risks. And many Americans complain it just doesn't feel like the holidays without the chill in the air. It's been a great snow season so far from the Rockies to the higher elevations in the Cascades and the Northern Sierras, and it's been the total opposite on the East Coast, said Bob Horofik, lead forecaster with the National Weather Service. Big parts of the country are basking in above average temperatures, especially east of the Mississippi and across the northern plains. Record warmth was expected on Christmas Eve along the East Coast, Horofik said. He laid the credit or blame with a strong El Niño, the warming of surface waters in the Pacific Ocean near the equator. That helped drive warm air west to east across the lower 48 and kept colder air from the Arctic at bay, he said. Editorial comment. That certainly speaks to that we live in a small, small world, equator and the Arctic. Continuing with the article. In the Pacific Northwest and California, the effects of El Niño haven't really hit yet. They're typically seen in January through March, and the heavy rains and snows in the region are probably not linked to the phenomenon, said Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. The winter in the Pacific Northwest is still predicted to be drier than normal, so the series of storms that dumped feet of snow in the Cascades this month and piled the snowpack back above normal were helpful, he said. Come summer, farmers and salmon alike will rely on that melting snow. In Washington, authorities have closed the state's main east-west route, Interstate 90, over the Cascade Mountains repeatedly this week due to heavy snows and avalanche danger. Officials closed a sledding hill near Snoqualmie Pass on Tuesday because a storm kept the state transportation department from plowing the parking lot. On Sunday, a heavy storm closed Oregon's Mount Ashland ski area where it knocked out power. California is in its driest four-year span on record, and experts anticipate a possible fifth-year drought. Weather forecasters say a strong El Niño weather system could drench the state, but one good wet winter won't be enough to rehydrate the parched land. A fresh round of chilly rain was expected to hit San Francisco late this week. The same system was expected to drop 4 feet of snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains. While ski resorts celebrated a deluge that threatened to drop almost 2 feet of snow in parts of Colorado mountains, forecasters warned of serious avalanche risks. An avalanche near the Wyoming-Montana state line on Sunday buried three snowmobilers, killing a 33-year-old North Dakota man. Another avalanche partially buried a ski patrol employee at the Snow Basin Resort, about 45 miles north of Salt Lake City, and two snowboarders were caught in a backcountry slide southwest of Breckenridge Ski Area on Saturday. They escaped serious injury. We're giving our general weak snowpack a very large and rapid load, and it's unlikely to be able to hold up, said Brian Lazar, deputy director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Warnings and advisories were posted for much of Colorado's high country, with an emphasis on the risk of danger slides and steep terrain. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service said the most recent storm had raised the level of Lake Tahoe about 2 inches since midnight Monday. Officials calculated that's nearly 64 billion gallons of water. 64 billion gallons. Elsewhere, severe thunderstorms and possible tornadoes were forecast for today in Arkansas, northern Alabama, northern Mississippi, and western Tennessee. Tornadoes are not unheard of in the region in late December, but the extreme weather, driven by warm temperatures and large amounts of moisture in the atmosphere, were nonetheless striking, said Jeff Masters, director of meteorology at Weather Underground. In addition to El Niño, a weather pattern called the North Atlantic Oscillation, OSCILLATION, North Atlantic Oscillation is helping keep cold air bottled up in the Arctic. Combine that with warm temperatures around the planet from man-made global warming, he said, and you have a recipe for intense weather. There are a couple of natural patterns at work, and then there's this human-caused component, too. With such balmy temperatures in the Northeast, Pine Oaks Golf Club in Easton, Massachusetts, is probably having its busiest December since it was built more than 50 years ago. A bonus for a club that doesn't count much on winter revenue. We've got 65 degrees coming up on Christmas Eve, said Scott Ibbotson, a golf specialist at the course. It'll be our busiest December day ever. Not everyone welcomed the warmth. Astrid Rao, 55, of Percassie, Pennsylvania, baked 16 kinds of Christmas cookies, but with the temperatures expected to reach 72 on Thursday, she had trouble getting in the holiday spirit. I associate cold with Christmas, she said, and if it's warm, it just doesn't feel right to me. End of that article. Continuing on the front page with local news, Meridian's Got Talent by Justin Kahn, a staff writer for the Herald and Review. Macon. Brock True tried not to let his fellow Meridian High School students see him shaking as he performed during Tuesday's talent show. True, a freshman, was looking down at the microphone as he sang. When he glanced up into the crowd filling the stadium seating in Meridian's new auditorium, he saw the students were holding up their cell phones with flashlights on, flashing back and swaying back and forth. I started smiling and just thought, yes, said True, who was performing publicly for the first time since fourth grade. True was awarded first place at the end of the show, which featured 11 student acts, the Meridian's teacher's rendition of 12 Days of Christmas, and a lip-sync battle between talent show host Phil Stylo and fellow Meridian teacher Kelly Milani. Stylo won with his Christmas in Hollis by Run DMC, beating Mimolani's I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas by Gayla Peavy. The students also had several contests, Name That Tune, Pictionary, The Answer Game, and Trivia, with winners taking home gift certificates from fast food restaurants. The auditorium, which is the latest finished improvement in the $45 million upgrade to the school, is state-of-the-art. It has built-in lights, professional sound, dressing rooms, soundproofing, and ability to shoot video. There are also new band and chorus rooms, which are soundproof. This place is cool, True said. I didn't realize the stage was going to be that big. It blew my expectations away. Meridian didn't officially have an auditorium before this one. They used to be a stage in what was known as a small gym, the old Macon High Gymnasium, but there wasn't much space, and acoustics in a gym aren't ideal. Quote, as the drama club expanded what they wanted to do and branched out into some bigger productions and musicals, we just didn't have space for it, unquote, Meridian principal Eric Hurlbrink said. He continues, in the past 4 or 5 years, we've had to go off-site to do a school play or musical. This will give us a chance to showcase our kids a lot better than what we've been able to do. In addition to concerts, musicals, and plays, the seats can be folded up and the room will serve as a cafetorium, Hurlbrink said. They'll be where our high school students eat lunch, he said. While the talent show was the auditorium's first use, the initial show for public consumption will be in March when the Meridian Drama Club presents its version of Rock of Ages. End of that article. More local, Webster Cantrell fundraiser underway, again by Justin Kahn of the Herald and Review. Decatur, faced with the problem of trying to expand services in a time when state funding for nonprofit organizations is at best uncertain, Webster Cantrell Hall took action. Still in his first year as Webster Cantrell Hall CEO, Martin Harris decided to hold a community fundraiser with a $50,000 goal. Currently, Webster Cantrell is halfway there and hopes to exceed it by December 31st. Because of the financial challenges we're facing, we decided to be proactive this year and reach out to the community, Harris said. Webster Cantrell Hall has served children and families at risk or in troubled circumstance in Decatur for more than 96 years, growing steadily to include a staff of 165, a 22-member board of directors, and an operating budget of more than $8 million. In addition to advocating and providing treatment, foster services, and an emergency shelter for children, Webster Cantrell is expanding its community-based services. It will soon become a Medicaid-certified provider, which will enable it to offer individual treatment for children and adults, family therapy, couples therapy, group therapy, and support groups. By the time most kids come to us, they've suffered more trauma than most people will ever suffer in a lifetime, Harris said. Sometimes it's too late. We need to be able to reach out to these kids and families earlier than in their evolution. Being able to treat the whole family will allow a more preventive perspective rather than always a reactive one. Most of those whom Webster Cantrell serves have moderate to acute mental health issues. Harris said treating those issues is important for a community trying to rebuild economically. The goal is to make a healthier community, Harris said. In order to have that, you have to have healthy families. In order to have a healthy economy, you have to have healthy families, he reiterates. Holly Newborn, Webster Cantrell Director of Development, said it's cheaper and more responsible to attack the problem early than to pay for the results later. Our goal is to make kids healthy, happy, contributing members of society, Newborn said. If our community isn't willing to help us financially now to get them to that point, they'll be putting it into taking care of them as adults. These kids will be in our community when they're adults, and we don't want to see them walking on the streets or continuing to suffer with mental illness. End of that article. Although the box at the end says to donate, to make a tax-deductible donation to Webster Cantrell Hall, call Holly Newbon at the at 423-6961 or to send a check to the center at 1942 East Cantrell Street, 62521. So you can still have time to do that. In the news here on the in the local section, a future bond issue loan topic, a pre-holiday Mount Zion meeting by Ryan Voiles from the staff. Mount Zion. The Mount Zion Village Board of Trustees got a special early Christmas gift Monday night, a quick and easy meeting. The board adjourned a mere 20 minutes after it first began with a present of a light agenda with only one action item and one extended discussion. That one topic focused on the potential sale of no more than $500,000 in bonds to help finance capital municipal improvements and pay off expenses thereafter. Village Administrator Julie Miller said the bonds are how the village helps pay for its roads and street projects, though no specific projects are currently earmarked for the funds. The 2015-2020 five-year capital improvement plan listed more than $2.7 million of street and drainage projects identified as necessary. Village officials said that without the bond action, they would be unable to fund any major street or drainage projects scheduled for next year. Per statute, the village had to hold a public hearing with regard to the bond action with a wait of at least 7 days before the board can vote on the plan. Miller said the issue is likely to be taken up during the board's second meeting in January. It must be filed with the county clerk by the end of February. The only other item on the agenda was approval of an annexation and rezoning of 8.57 acres of property off Britton Lane for residential purposes. The board does not typically make it a habit a quick meeting before Christmas, but Miller said afterward it was just a happy coincidence. We're certainly not going to complain. End of that article. Continuing with local, Dove Deliveries Inspire Volunteers. This is by Valerie Wells. Decatur. Helen Kowalczyk has volunteered to help deliver Christmas baskets from Dove, Inc. and Northeast Community Fund's joint effort for the last several years. This year, she also brought her daughters Kaylee and Emery to help. It's just to do something nice for someone else at Christmas, Kaylee said. Most years, said Angie, And yeah, most years, said Angie Williams, who coordinates the project and works at Dove as a shelter specialist, they schedule deliveries on a Saturday to make it as convenient as possible for volunteers. But with Christmas Day on Friday, they worried the food for Christmas dinners wouldn't keep at recipients' home. So the deliveries were on Tuesday. That cut down on volunteers, she said. Usually we're a lot further along than this mid-morning, she said. First United Methodist Church donates the use of the basement meeting room, where volunteers sorted and packed gift bags last week, including a roll of wrapping paper and tape. Presents are packed into black plastic garbage bags so the children can't see what's in them, and the paper and tape are included so the parents can wrap them themselves and feel like they had a part in providing Christmas for their kids, Williams said. Donations come from businesses, churches and individuals, and community groups, some of which held special events to collect toys. They always have plenty of gifts for small children, but not as many for teens, especially boys and adults, Williams said. Recipients sign up ahead of time and provide sizes and wish lists, which Dove tries to fulfill. The food baskets come from Northeast Community Fund. The food baskets contain Christmas dinner fixings, but also personal care products, toilet paper, paper towels, extra fruit, milk, meat, eggs, bacon, and ham to provide several meals for recipients. We're serving probably about the same number as last year, 360 families, said Jerry Pels, director of Northeast Fund. We had many more adoptions this year, which was very helpful and pushed the number up closer to 400 families we're able to serve. End of that article. Another local out of Shelbyville. Shelbyville yard waste and sewers costly. Shelbyville. This is by Sharon Barraclough for the Herald and Review. Residents who push their yard waste into city streets are causing expensive storm sewer problems, the city council learned Monday night. Council member Tom Schaefer, who is the city street commissioner, told the council that despite warnings not to do so, many homeowners rake and blow their leaves off the curb and into the street, expecting the city to dispose of them. We simply don't have the budget to sweep all the streets constantly like this would require. It's become a real problem. Grass clippings and leaves left in the gutters lead to clogged sewers. Then people complain when we get heavy rain because their streets flooded or water's backing up into their yard, Schaefer said. Over and over again, this is because the storm sewers are clogged with yard waste. Council member Bill Schuff, who serves as the city sewer commissioner, said his department has spent almost $20,000 in cleaning out equipment clogged with yard waste in 2015. It's a real problem and it's costing some real money, he said. Shelbyville doesn't have a city yard waste dump where people can bring their clippings and leaves instead of leaving them on the curb. Between the grass clippings in the summer, the leaves in the fall, and the branches in the spring, we have a real mess, Schaefer said. I appreciate people wanting to keep their yards looking nice, but this is causing expensive problems. End of that article. Some shorts in the news. Bloomington, family escapes fire. A family of four was displaced after an early morning fire Tuesday in Bloomington. Firefighters found two adults and two children outside the house just before 4 a.m. Fire was coming from two windows of an attached garage with fire nearing the house. The garage sustained the heaviest damage, but the house also had smoke, water, and minor fire damage. Damages were estimated at about $20,000. No injuries were reported, and the fire cause is still under investigation. Mattoon, Civil War Monument. Fundraising has begun for a bronze sculpture, The Last Century, that will be the centerpiece of the new Mattoon Civil War Memorial Ellipse. Project organizers indicated a recently extended law enables those ages 70 and a half and older to donate to nonprofit causes using their IRA accounts and not to have to pay income tax on the withdrawal. The memorial honors the five Illinois infantry regiments that were organized at Camp Grant in Mattoon during the Civil War, and the site's early commanding officer and namesake, Ulysses S. Grant. Steve Thompson, project manager with the Ellipse Project Steering Committee, said the planned sculpture will depict a lone Union infantryman standing watch over the former grounds of Camp Grant. Thompson said the committee's goal is to raise $135,000. Prospective donors can contact Thompson at 234-6004, 234-6004, or visit the Mattoon Civil War Memorial Ellipse page on Facebook. Nioga, babysitter to trial. A Cumberland County judge has decided a 21-year-old woman will stand trial in the death of a 1-year-old girl who she was babysitting. Natasha L. Gordon of Neoga had pleaded not guilty to involuntary manslaughter in the August 27th death of Ariana McNeil. Special Agent Timothy Brown of the Illinois State Police testified Monday that Gordon told him she left Ariana in the bathtub with her boyfriend's 3-year-old daughter while she stepped onto the porch to speak with her boyfriend. He testified that Gordon said Ariana was face down in the tub when she went to check on the children. An autopsy performed on the toddler couldn't determine a cause of death and showed no signs of trauma. A pretrial hearing is scheduled for February 1st. Chicago. 6-person juries next. A Cook County judge said a new Illinois law that cut the size of a civil case juries from 12 to 6 people is unconstitutional. Judge William Gomelisky ruled Monday the Illinois Constitution provides for 12-person juries. He said that may not be altered by statute. The legislature and then-Governor Pat Quinn approved the law in 2014. It took effect June 1st. The measure also more than doubled jurors' pay. Supporters said higher pay would create more diverse juries and reducing jury size would help alleviate the cost of paying more. Defense attorneys argued the change benefited plaintiffs' lawyers who would have to persuade fewer jurors to side with them. A plaintiff's attorney said he plans to appeal. In Crime and Courts by Huey Freeman, also a staff writer for Herald and Review, Joshua King sentenced to 12 years for scalding child's hands. Decatur. Joshua Pierre King was sentenced to 12 years in prison by Circuit Judge Thomas E. Griffith for burning a child's hands in scalding water after hearing testimony on the severity of the victim's injuries. He also heard testimony who said King was a loving father and husband as well as a dedicated church youth leader. King, 28, of Decatur, was convicted by Griffith of Class X aggravated battery of a child with an enhancement for exceptionally brutal or heinous behavior indicative of wanton cruelty at a bench trial that concluded November 12th. The sentencing guideline was 6 to 60 years. At the hearing Tuesday, Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott recommended a 40-year sentence. Assistant Public Defender Karen Root asked for a minimum term. With the sentence to be carried out at a minimum of 85% and credit with time served since October 2014, King will be eligible for parole in 2024. The victim, who was 7 years old when the incident occurred on October 1, 2014, prepared a victim impact statement, which was read to the court by child advocate Allison Elsay. The boy said Joshua's actions affected his life. "I'm having bedwetting, nightmares, and it makes me feel sad," Elsay read from the witness stand. "When my hands get burnt, it felt like my whole body got burnt." The boy's grandfather, who's raising him, wrote in a statement, "The injuries have affected the boy in many ways. He has damage to the cartilage in his hands, and he has to wear pressure gloves to keep the swelling down, in addition to splint to straighten out his hands. He has to undergo physical and occupational therapy, as well as see 2 counselors weekly. It's heart-wrenching to watch him struggle, trying to grasp and hold a ball, like most children do. The teasing of children at school has caused a great effect on his behavior at school. He feels no one likes him. He's different and doesn't fit in," Elsie said, reading from the grandfather's statement. "He's an awesome little boy who needs love and assurance." The boy was not in the courtroom or at King's trial. King read a statement he had prepared on his own behalf. "I just want to apologize to anyone I caused harm to," King said, adding he hopes they forgive him as his heavenly father forgives him. With about 15 supporters in the gallery, King sang, "Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. And I know who holds the future and life is worth living, because my Savior lives." That's the end of that article and the end of that local section. Actually, the next page is local too. Vehicle body found in Evergreen Lake by Maria Nagel and David Prober of the Lee News Service, Hudson. A 37-year-old Peoria man drowned in his car, which was pulled from Evergreen Lake Tuesday afternoon after fishermen saw skid marks and muddy tire tracks headed toward the water. Patrick M. McGurdy, formerly of Monongah, was pronounced dead at 1:31 p.m. at the scene at 12676 East 2500 North Road near the Lake Evergreen Pump House, according to McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis. Davis. He was alone in the car and was wearing a seatbelt when he was found, she said. Preliminary autopsy results indicate he drowned, but toxicology tests results remain pending, Davis said. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage said no foul play is suspected, and the ongoing investigation is being treated as an accident case. He said authorities don't know how long the car was in the water or why McGurdy was at the lake, but they hope the interviews with family will help to reconstruct the timeline. Tony Clem of Downs said he was fishing with a friend about 7:15 a.m. near the pump station when they noticed muddy tire tracks going into the lake. They told a City of Bloomington employee who was collecting trash, and he reported the incident. The tracks were only going one way. We thought we better get somebody out here. That's when the city workers showed up and radioed it in. Members of the Hudson dive team searching about 20 feet from the bank found the car after about 20 minutes. Officials from the Sheriff's Department and the Hudson Fire Department were also at the scene. Skid marks on the pavement and tire tracks in the grass indicated the car apparently was heading northwest when it went off the road where it curves near the pump station. The scene is across the lake from the West Boat Launch, where at least three vehicles have gone into the water and people have died since 2002. Barriers and warning signs were installed there in December 2014. Earlier, Sandage said the department had no missing persons report and no reports of accident. He also said that the victim is not connected to the Hudson. He also said the victim is not connected to a missing persons case in Livingston County. There's a picture in the paper of the Hudson dive team preparing Tuesday afternoon to enter the water where the vehicle went in the north end there. End of that article. And to close section one, they call this a state case. I'd call it national. It's out of Austin, Texas. A P. Bland case highlights some lax Texas state police practices. Austin, Texas, AP. A Texas grand jury that declined to indict anyone over the jailhouse death of Sandra Bland could still charge the trooper who shouted, "I will light you up," during a traffic stop, resulting in her arrest, a move that would focus attention on a state police force experts say has lagged behind widely accepted U.S. law enforcement practices to head off misconduct. A grand jury on Monday decided that no felony crime was committed by sheriff's officers or jailers in the death of the 28-year-old black woman from Chicago. Authorities say Bland hanged herself in jail with a plastic garbage bag 3 days after Trooper Brian Encinia pulled her over for not signaling a lane change. Encinia, who is white, has been on paid desk duty since the confrontation recorded on dash cam video heightened national concern about police treatment of African Americans. Critics included Bland's family wondered why a routine traffic stop escalated into an altercation that led to Janina brandishing a stun gun and making the threat to light her up. The stop has also invited scrutiny of the Texas Department of Public Safety that oversees state police. Records obtained by the Associated Press show at least 6 formal complaints that have been found valid since the beginning of 2012 against members of the nearly 4,000-strong force for violating traffic stop procedures. The kind of incidents like the one involving Encinia and Bland. Two troopers received written reprimands and others received suspensions ranging from 1 to 30 days without pay. So, in conclusion here, as we end page 2, talking about some news. In October, the agency began using computer software designed to document trooper issues in real time and provide supervisors with automatic alerts when early intervention is needed. DPS spokesman Tom Vinger said the agency's new software will begin capturing various citizen concerns that don't rise to full complaints. If cleared of criminal wrongdoing by the grand jury, Encina would still face internal discipline. McCraw has acknowledged that Encina violated routine practices for conduct during the traffic stop. This is the end of part one of the Decatur Herald and Review. I'll be back shortly.